You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 10, hashtag songs for Schlaudi, I see, is just about trending. It's lovely. We'll get back to you a little bit later. But this hour, as promised, we've got Sesonkem Semang in the studio with us. We're going to turn just up the heat a little bit, not with the conversation. It's so cold in here. I can see her shivering a little bit. And that was my doing when I came in this morning from gym. It was too hot. You know, just thought I'd slip in there that I went to gym before
Some
the show.
Some of us didn't.
So we'll just get it up. Thank you so much, Danayo. The framing question for this hour, and it's going to be a wide-ranging conversation. I wanted an excuse to have a year on the wireless while she's been in the country visiting for a couple of weeks. But the framing question will be diversity. Diversity as a value fascinates me. If you are, like I know some of our listeners are, stands for Zadie Smith. We all grew up, especially in the 80s, 90s in particular, drunk on the promise of multiculturalism, diversity, pluralism, and other synonyms that you interchange. And Western Europe and places like the Netherlands in particular seem to be almost the gold standard of tolerance and diversity. Fast forward to Planet Trump, and suddenly you have a world in which there seems to be enormous social and political pressure that has been brought on the value, against the values of diversity, multiculturalism, pluralism, whichever is your favorite of those, slightly different words, but more or less picking out the same thing. So here's my question to you this hour. Do you think that diversity is a value that is central to life in South Africa? Or do you think diversity is dead? Do you think multiculturalism is dead here, around the continent, and globally as well? Or do you think that it's not yet dead? It just needs a little bit of TLC. Give us a call throughout and let's have that conversation on 011-883-0702. And of course, in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. After your latte and after a minute or two, you'll feel warm as a sonke. But thank you so much for coming in. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. And good morning to all the listeners.
Speaking of beautiful people with multiculturalism in their DNA, the wonderful Canadians were responsible for you meditating on this particular question. But of course, for years, sometimes directly, sometimes obliquely, you have been wondering a lot about how demands for justice, especially racial justice, sometimes come up against romantic notions of a fruit salad of beings in one geography.
That's right. I mean, for me, as a South African who's in my 40s, I am still very much influenced by and mindful of and thinking about the sort of first 10 years of our new dispensation, which was the whole idea of the Rainbow Nation and how influential the thinking of people like Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu was for framing the transition into a democracy around this idea of a rainbow. Mm. And so that constantly sort of intrigues me, and I think about it a lot, in part obviously because I have critiques of that idea, of the sentimentalism, of what gets glossed over when you talk about the rainbow, of the fact that in many ways rainbowism was a sort of a panacea that didn't allow us to deal with a lot of questions of justice. So part of why I'm interested in the idea is because I think it's problematic. And then there's another part of me that is interested in the idea because I think that there's something idealistic about getting along even in the face of deep inequalities. And I want to believe that when you live in a country that is striving to be better, there has to be a national conversation that helps us to be a nation. Mm. So this is where it comes from. This is my constant quest, no matter what I'm writing about. And I was listening to the caller earlier, Boosie, who phoned in earlier, and her sense of urgency and her sense of this idea that we keep on forgetting. You know, something happens and then we move on and we forget. Mm. And your pushback saying, no, that's not true. We can hold many things at one time. And I think part of what, you know, if I were to be engaged in that conversation, part of what compels me is this idea that I'm always interested in what's happening underneath the news stories. When I first started writing, I wrote a lot about the news stories. I wrote a lot about President Zuma, about my disappointment with him, with the politics of the day. And I think that's important. But there are lots of people writing about that. So I'm more and more interested in what's happening underneath the skin of the politics.
I was thinking a little bit yesterday about radical economic transformation, which I wrote my column for this week's Mail and Guardian coming out on tomorrow. And I was trying to understand, what is it about the lure of Jacob Zuma in 2007 that made him an attractive figure for the left at the time? And it seems to me that it was the promise of economic justice or economic democracy. What are your reflections on why it is that legitimate disappointment that we have as South Africans with not yet living in a just society? Why should one of the manifestations of our deep disappointment at living in this strange, unjust society, why should it be that values like diversity, tolerance, pluralism, multiculturalism should be part of what it is that we are prepared to, if we were generous, problematize, if we were honest, chuck out the window? Can't we both be annoyed that we live in an unjust world and still hold certain values dear without thinking that we're just being romantic?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to grapple with. And I think it's a very difficult thing to do, in part because the whole Rainbow Project has been so discredited, because multiculturalism and diversity and all these sentimental words are so often used to prop up people who want to continue to be unjust. So, you know, to put it bluntly, lots of white South Africans love the terms of multiculturalism and diversity and pluralism, because in lots of societies, those are the words that are used to defend minority rights. And in many contexts, that's very important, because minorities are under siege. And in South Africa, it's the opposite, right? In South Africa, the white minority is not under siege. The white minority has the vast majority of the economic power, social capital, all of that stuff. So there's a way in which liberals, white and black, love pluralism, because in other contexts, protecting and defending the rights of minorities is very important for all those reasons. And yet in the South African context, it's kind of upside down. Of course, it's important to protect minorities, even white people who have a lot of power. The principle of protecting minorities is important. But I think it's also important to recognize that in this context, the white minorities are very powerful, right? To quote myself, a column I once wrote was the strongest victims in the world, this notion of victimization amongst white people. And pluralism kind of lets people off the hook.
Okay.
So that's part of why people want to throw it out. That's part of why people want to throw out the Rainbow Nation idea. And what I want to say is, can we claim something about getting along, not necessarily with white people, not that I don't want to get along with white people, but part of my interest in diversity is talking about the other South Africans who we never talk about. Colored people, Indian people, black people, African people. How do we get along without whiteness always being the reference point, the central kind of part of our narrative? Is it possible for white people just be listening, Jay? They don't have to necessarily be the center of our conversation. Again, not in a sentimental way, but in one that takes the idea of diversity further than the Liberal Project would.
I'm really looking forward to you developing what is for you as a writer the most precise description of this project. And I enjoyed your public lecture the other day, but it was almost, in philosophical terms, like as Immanuel Kant's one title says, a prolegomena. It's a promise of a future project. Because as much as it's fun for radio purposes to use some of these terms loosely, I want you to just think aloud for me, Sasonka. Is your hope, and help me out here, to try and develop a solidarity politics that takes seriously, especially what young South Africans and South Africans like Busi from our open line think are the shortcomings of this society, but you want to hold on to it? Or do you want to properly say, listen, I don't give a damn that some liberal is protecting their privilege by saying, multiculturalism, let's all get along. I, as Sasonke, and proudly advocating diversity, pluralism, multiculturalism. And I want to spell out what that means, even in the face of those who are using it as a ruse.
No, I think it's the former. So part of what inspired, so I was asked to do this lecture on diversity. It's not a topic that I've thought deeply about, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought it's actually important to investigate this. And part of it was, you know, in the protests that we've seen in the last few weeks, there was this constant tension. On the Friday, the protests were largely protests that were participated in by white people. And then on the Wednesday, we saw much larger protests, which were carried out by the opposition parties and largely black. And I was very curious about this whole idea, one that I largely agree with, which raises questions about the basis of white people's sudden interest in the political sphere. So, you know, the thing that people, you know, you heard over and over again is white people were not interested in when it came to Marikana. And of course, I'm using broad generalizations. Sure. I'm sure I'll get, you know, some pushback on this, but I'm speaking loosely for the sake of conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So white people were not interested in Marikana, and then when the Rand falls and the white monopoly capital is questioned, then we see them kind of responding. And I think that's a very important and interesting point. And I think it's also one that our politicians, and in particular our president, is very good at exploiting. The idea that, in fact, South Africans are so divided. Jacob Zuma did not create the divide amongst South Africans. But South Africans are so divided that we do not even know how to protest together yet. Mm-hmm. Yet. So part of my interest in diversity is this question about what is the basis upon which we are South Africans? How do we belong to this nation together if we continue to be so deeply divided? And I understand and recognize and think the divides have lots of bases. So that's the black and white question on the one hand. And then if you push that a little bit further and then you say, if we are to recognize that white people continue to have most of the power and that there is often very little basis for genuine political action type of trust that you can develop with white people if they are going to only show up when the issues affect them, then where else do we look to find bonds of solidarity? That is an easier sell in terms of trust. Mm. Again, not to elide or to ignore racial divisions and tensions that exist amongst other South Africans. But surely if we are a nation trying to belong to one another, where there are bases for commonality, we need to think about and look for solidarity in broader and more deeper ways. Absolutely. And so that's part of what I'm interested in. And beyond politics, obviously, when we look at culture, my lecture also was very interested in the 3.1 million people who live in South Africa and who are technically not South Africans. What do we do with those people? They live in South Africa. Are they part of us? Are they not part of us? If we talk about diversity and multiculturalism, what do we do with those people who are largely African and whom we have refused to accept? How do we belong as a nation? Is it on the basis of history, because we all survived apartheid together? Or is it on the basis of something else, some other values? And if that's the case, how do we move towards that in a way? And so diversity begins to provide a language for that. Maybe not good enough, but as you're saying, sure. I'm still searching. Mm. I'm not in any way saying that I figured this particular piece out.
Okay, if you listen to the conversation, you can ask any question of Sisonke Msimang. You can join the conversation, agree, disagree, tell your own stories. Where are you at when it comes to this philosophical conundrum? That there is something to be, I think, certainly as speaking for myself here as Eusebius, there is something here to hold on to in holding dear values like pluralism and multiculturalism. But I'm profoundly aware, like Sisonke, that there are urgent, important, and cogent critiques of multiculturalism. She spelled some of them out. The fear that some people who share these values with us are secretly just trying to hold on to their privilege. Do you buy that? Where are you at? Give us a call on 011-883-0702. And of course, in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. 21 minutes after 10. It says on Twitter, Eusebius, I thought that Sisonke's take on this is excellent because of the way that she's highlighting you know, the perspective we rely on to understand multiculturalism while being nuanced about some of the critiques. Modus says, I don't know if this was your intention. She's serving flames. A lot here to mull over. And someone else saying, yeah, she's sounding brilliant, sounding as fluent as my other fave, Professor Gola. Yeah, black woman slay. Absolutely. Henny and Precious, I'm going to come to you in a second. So, Sonke, I want us to just rehearse a conversation we had during the break there. Part of what makes this conversation difficult, although I can promise you people are enjoying it, is, of course, we human beings like dichotomies. We like to carve up the world in dichotomies. Either you are pro-multiculturalism and anti-justice, or you are very radical, pro-justice and anti-multiculturalism.
That's right.
And there's something attractive about dichotomies, but invariably, they also inaccurate.
Yeah, and I think that they lead us into traps. And they also, for some people, I mean, certainly for me, what I found is that when I follow a line, one particular line of thinking, it forces me also to be a person I'm not. So there's something inauthentic about choosing only one path. Sometimes, sometimes, of course, it's very important to stake a claim and to say this is what it is. Mm. But the reality of living in South Africa is you cannot help but meet someone who looks particularly different from you, who has a world experience, a life experience that you learn from in fundamental ways, and then hold on to the idea that multiculturalism is simply a scapegoat for white liberals, right? So there's something about the lived experience of interacting with people. Yesterday, I was in the in our version of Brooklyn. So I was in Maboneng precinct. And it was such an interesting experience. I mean, for all of its problems, to be in Maboneng and to be sitting in an Ethiopian restaurant that is owned by someone who arrived in this country as a refugee, fleeing conflict. And here he is, has an establishment and is employing three South Africans. Mm. So on the one hand, I could throw out multiculturalism and say it's just nonsense. But on the other hand, that is a reality that three people are being employed by this man who came here with nothing. So yeah, I think the dichotomies don't account for real life.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got lots of calls. Let's just take them in turn. And as I said, it's a dynamic conversation. You can call in and we can take it whichever direction you want. You've heard there some very fascinating, substantive comments, remarks, and one or two arguments from Sesonke thus far. Let's first go to Henny. How's it, Henny? Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Sesonke, I would love to ask one thing. Can't we get rid of the words black and white? Because I think if we can do that, and we can talk about a nation, South Africans, we will cut all of these problems out. We have to get rid of black and white. So there are two soccer. If you talk about two soccer teams, is people like.
Okay, we're losing Henny there a little bit, but we got the gist of the question.
So I think, again, Henny's trying to force us into a false dichotomy. We must talk about black and white because we live in a racialized economy, a racialized economy in which, for the most part, white people continue to dominate the industry and the private sector. If you just look statistically at the number of black people who sit on boards, so we're talking about ownership here, not just employment, we continue to be in a very seriously racialized economy. So we can't throw away black and white, and it's not useful, I think, to anybody, but particularly white people, to throw black and white away. I mean, we often act as though talking about black and white is something that serves black people. But in fact, I think it's very, very important for everybody in this country to continue to describe things accurately and realistically. And so it is important to do that. It is also important to recognize that we can talk about black and white and still be building, attempting to build a nation. Part of the problem of the crisis of leadership in this country is that there is nobody anymore who has, who sits within government, who has the kind of moral authority that allows them to talk about and imagine a nation of South Africans that is moving towards a place where we belong together, jostling with our difficulties and our difference.
The other strange thing, and I don't know. For me, this is not just a conceptual point. I mean, I think this is a matter of lived experience, of how we see ourselves and how we move through the world. Is the assumption that some people have that a commitment to diversity presupposes that you are on board with colorblind politics?
Exactly.
But I don't understand why that need be the case.
I mean
you can live in a world in which your language is never color coded, and you can be a racist and a bigot and intolerant and not actually display a genuine commitment to diversity and to pluralism. And equally, you can walk around and you can see there's a colored talk show host, there's a black woman that is interviewing, and have, which we'll get to later, cross-racial friendship in a deep philosophical sense.
I, in fact, think that in some ways they go together. I think that people who, and often it's unintentional. So I think Henny calls with goodwill, and people who want us to not talk about black and white are often moving from a starting point that assumes that naming it means that we are causing division or highlighting division. And so I think this is part of the racial literacy that is very important for us to build as a nation. Part of dropping the ball on the Rainbow Nation project was not deepening the discourse, or was not continuing to have these conversations in a way that people understand. So no, I think color blindness is dangerous. I think it leads to sentimentality, and it leads to pushing things under the rug, and it only serves the people who are benefiting from the racialized society we live in. So even as Henny is trying to say, let's not talk about black and white because it's divisive, a black person cannot afford to say that. A black person needs to talk about black and white because it explains the terms under which they live on a daily basis that aren't so great.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think colorblindness is not a good strategy. It doesn't help.
One of the other beautiful things about diversity that I don't want us to lose in this conversation, just because it is a pitfall when diversity is discussed in South Africa, is that almost any trait, be it a biological one or a socially constructed one, can be the basis for diverse ways of being.
Mm. Absolutely. So because of our history, it's so easy to talk about diversity as race. We use it as a substitute. And part of why I talk about the 3.1 million people who live in this country, who represent a very large and diverse segment of people who are African migrants. Part of why I do that is because I want to open out the conversation to say that diversity is so much bigger than and more than. So it is, of course, the various so-called racial identities that apartheid put us in, but it is also a diversity of language, of food, of sexual orientation, of all these principles that are in our constitution that we haven't yet had a chance to explore and focus on through public conversation, because we've been understandably caught up in our racial story. So our racial story is important. It continues to structure a lot of our relationships and the way in which people live their daily life. But I want to insist that we open out the conversation about what it means to be South African to be a bigger conversation than simply a racial conversation.
Why is diversity valuable?
So in two reasons. One is very instrumental. And so when you have people who are different from one another and who are either racially different or culturally different, and they are able to overcome economic divisions, then you have a higher chance of amplifying social capital. So if we accept that that white people have more social capital, more access to resources than black people of any kind in South Africa, when you are able to bridge a divide there, then you have a better chance that two friends, a black one and a white one, will start a business together. And then daddy's business, white daddy's business empire, is able to benefit somebody else, right? So that's a very crude and probably problematic example, but I just use it to talk about.
But it's important. I mean, you know better than me how debates about diversity in law played out in America, where you spent some time. And they weren't able, as we can, constitutionally and politically, to say we value diversity for its own sake. And so you find, for example, that when it came to affirmative action, when it came to law schools and the admissions policy, one of the things, and Americans love doing these things empirically, and when they get it right, they do it well, was to prove, like you say, the instrumental benefit of having people who look, sound, live differently to you, come from different spaces. It makes a demonstrable difference to your own lived experiences, education, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep, and it's better for the economy.
I mean, it's tempting to feel like one is being romantic, like, you know, gazing at a picture of still life. But there's a genuine there's genuine value there. And I'm asking it in the middle of this conversation because I know that some of the skeptics, some of the young ones, some of the ones who are you know, radical on the streets, moderate between the sheets, may think, oh, please, you guys are just romanticizing it. But there's important value to be to be lifted to the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think at a national level, given the economic crisis in which we are now sitting, with people talking about radical economic transformation all of a sudden, given the situation we're in, what this economy needs more than anything is innovation. And if there are societies that are innovative, they are societies that embrace multiculturalism and diversity. And societies that are stagnant, so if we look at Europe today, if we look at America today, the limits of what that country is hitting up against, it's hitting up against this idea that multiculturalism is dead, that there is no place actually for people to go to that country and be whatever it is that they want to be. And so my sense is that if we fall into that trap of seeing diversity and multiculturalism that is already here in South Africa, but is being seen as a problem, if we continue to see it as a problem, it will be a problem. If we are able to embrace it and recognize that people who come from other places, people who are not the mainstream, small, historically established, that's where the ideas are. If you look around South Africa today, who are the most interesting, thoughtful, creative people? They are people who have a sort of cultural cosmopolitanism, who can cross bridges and divides. And it seems to me that's the value of diversity.
Kirk and Claudia, I'm going to come to you in a second. I want to personalize it a little bit by asking you, Sasonka, just to reflect. And of course, the full version is in Sasonka's forthcoming book later this year. I mean, you were raised across continents and countries on this continent, and also North America, Canada, and then, you know, studying in the States, coming back, and now living down under as well. What in your own personal experience has been obvious advantages of being forced to always feel slightly distant, but also temporarily belonging to different locales?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in Zambia and then Kenya and then Canada and the US and then back home for the last, you know, 15 years and then in Australia for 2 years, there's something about being an immigrant that is both makes you very vulnerable. You have to stand outside and watch so that you learn the rules, so that you understand how things work in this in whatever particular society you're in. There's something about being a refugee, obviously, that makes you vulnerable. Someone without papers, without access to the formal things that make other people in that society safe. So those are all experiences I personally understand and know well. But of course, being someone who is not from a place also allows you to know that place particularly well, because you have to study it. And it also gives you access, because you have to be out there. You have to be the one who says, hi, you know, when you're a little kid and you're, you know, new in that school again, you have to be the one who says hello. And being the one who says hello forces you to be the one who people come to, who people respond to, various people. So being an outsider forces you to be a collector of different kinds of people, in a sense. So it's personal to me.
What can we do in South Africa if there's a mom, a dad, or just a person thinking about their own personal journeys in terms of this values conversation? What can we do if we don't have the privilege and the access to opportunity, money, class mobility to live in Zambia, Kenya, Canada, to get a similar kind of educational and phenomenological benefit of traveling? And I'm asking this question partly because I suspect, even if there isn't a strong link, there must be at least a weak link between a genuine, deep, and a critical appreciation of multiculturalism and traveling. And sometimes as South Africans, yeah, part of the reason why we have so much Afrophobia,
yeah,
and xenophobia is because we think nothing happens north of the Limpopo.
That's right. Or certainly nothing good. And it's compounded by the fact that a lot of people who we find in our country have left their countries because things are not good. So then it gives a lot of us in South Africa the sense that if people are running away because things are not good and they're coming here, where things aren't that great themselves, so it's important to recognize the pressure people are under. South Africans, poor South Africans are under themselves. Mm. I think that's precisely right, Eusebius. So how do you travel without traveling? How do you be multicultural without class access? It's easy for me to say all this stuff. I think the one is to recognize that we are already a multicultural society, and so the person who owns a spaza shop is often a Somali or a Pakistani or a Bangladeshi. And while it is sometimes easier to have a conflictual relationship with someone, it is also possible not to have a conflictual relationship with someone. And part of doing that is asking questions. So I think asking people about their journeys is profoundly powerful. There's this quote that I love. And it says there isn't anyone you couldn't love once you've found out their story. Mm-hmm. And I think people on radio know this very well, that you start out with someone who might be an angry caller and then you ask them a few questions and you realize. So I think that there is, at an interpersonal level, this is not going to deal with the big structural questions, but an interpersonal level, if you are living in a particular community and there is someone who doesn't look like you and it is clear that they are from X place, ask a question. Mm-hmm. Because that journey is a very important one.
Absolutely. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. But first, Kirk, thank you so much for your patience and for calling in.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Listening to the conversation has been quite enlightening. But I think within South Africa, we are stuck in this blame game. And the white people blaming the black ANC government, the ANC government for our current horrible status, never mind economic, but in all other areas. And black people or people of color blaming the issue, the main problem being white capital and the white status, the white control status quo. I don't think it serves anybody any good. I think my perception is that I know the history of a lot of the history of South Africa. I know where white capital and white privilege, the reality is there. Yes, it is the case. Mm. But I think the most important focus on, we can't do anything about the white privilege that is currently in place. What we can try to change is our current status, where we have a mostly non-functional government, a mostly non-functional economy. And I think if we focus on that, the multicultural aspect of our society will partly be healed as a natural consequence.
You know, it's such an interesting theory because Sasonke gave a very memorable lecture with Lebo Mashile 3 years ago?
3 years ago.
3 years ago in the Ruth First. And this relationship between, at the level of systems and structures and the state versus interpersonal relationship. And what I found particularly attractive about the argument that Sasonke performed with Lebo is that if in our daily interactions, me and Kuis forge a deep, philosophically rich friendship, then the opposite will happen to what Kirk is saying. And obviously this can be in both directions, so it's not either or. That a lot of those big policy questions about this state, affirmative action, BEE, will recede into the background because just with your example around traveling without traveling, if you have deep empathy for someone else by asking them, what is your story, then a lot can flow from that as well. So I don't know what to make of that, but I wonder where you're at because I feel the pull of what Kirk is saying, but then I'm also recalling the importance of the interpersonal that you have focused on in some of your recent work?
So I think both are true. And this is sort of where I tried to land with Ruth first. And so I hear what Kirk is saying. The nuance that I would add to Kirk's comment is that we actually can do something about white privilege, and that we actually have a government full of bad leaders, but full of policies that would work if they had the right type of leadership. So I think with all the tweaks and things that we have tried to do around affirmative action and BEE, those are policies that are precisely established to try and make inroads into white privilege. So it's important not to forget that there is an architecture and a state that is working precisely on this question of white privilege on a daily basis, or at least should be. And that part of the problem is that whenever you have any kind of policies, especially difficult ones like affirmative action and black economic empowerment, they need to be walked forward with people who are explaining them, who are bridge builders, who are able to say this. Let's remember why we are doing this. This is something that serves all South Africans. So where I would disagree with Kirk is that we can and we should be doing something about white privilege. That's the role of the state. And then at the same time, I agree with Kirk that we do need to be focusing on the present, on trying to build new relationships, even as we recognize the old. So the title of my talk was Eyes in the Back of Our Head, looking backwards while being able to move forward. I think we constantly, it's a tension. It's a very difficult thing South Africans must do. Remember the past, look at the past so that we're not fooled and so we don't make that mistake again, because people are worried that apartheid can come back if we don't watch ourselves, because racially we haven't transformed enough. At the same time, we must look towards the future and be able to forge new relationships, which is why I'm interested in relationships between people who aren't white. Mm. I'm very interested in that. So I will continue to remind us that whiteness should, and this is part of my interest in the present and the future, that whiteness needs to assume its proper place in the society. It's disproportionate. It takes up too much of our time and energy. So I don't say that in a way to be mean to white people. I say that in a way that expands our notion of who we are as South Africans. We aren't just black and white. And we cannot use white as a reference point so much. We must be able to build, I understand why we do it, but we must be able to build a bigger sense of belonging in which white people assume their rightful place so that they too understand that they aren't the center of South African discourse.
Absolutely. 12 minutes before 11. Learning new words, eh? Jeez, clever listeners. Mbali says, Sisonka is a perfect aptonym. I've never heard that word before. And it is, according to Google, a person's name that is regarded as amusingly appropriate to their occupation. Sisonke. I love that. Claude's, good morning. Okay, we've lost Claude there, but we've got Claudia on the line, who's being patient. Hello, Claudia.
Hello. Sorry for my English.
That's the last. That's, don't have to worry about your English. We're talking multiculturalism after all.
Yes, they all told me. But anyway, I'm not South African, and I was happy when you were speaking about like take it personally. So speak with the person that you don't look at the color of the skin, because one of the things that since I'm here is 4 years. Sometimes I would like to scream, don't look at my skin, because I'm white, but what can I do? I came here 20 years ago. I was on the street in Europe to scream Mandela free and to fight for the freedom of this country. And 4 years ago, they asked my husband to come here. They offered a job. We had both a great job in Europe. So we could stay there with our family and so, but we say, okay, it's a great adventure, why not? There was not a professor in South Africa who could teach what he's teaching, and so they called someone from Europe. But in the last year, I feel that, I don't know, I would not be white, and it's terrible, because I don't care about the color of the skin, and
yeah, the line is not
it's
great
terrible,
there. Sokka, you must come visit
point.
More often. Otherwise, we're going to have you on Skype. Because there are at least two conversations I want to silo off in the interest of time. The one is to come back to friendship, right? And then there's one that Claudia, I think, is opening up, but you can comment for 40 seconds or so, then we'll take one or two more calls. And I think her point, which is why I think it needs to be a self-standing conversation, is what is a good ally to do?
That's
the Max
right.
Dupria problem, the yep. Helen Ziller problem. But I was such a good ally, and I mean this sincerely,
yeah.
I'm not trying to be yeah. sarcastic.
Yeah.
How do I now deal with an upstart telling me, but you're white, but you're straight, but you're a butch gay man, or whatever?
Yeah. So I think this is why empathy and listening and understanding become very important. Because when people who you say that you respect and who you want to help tell you that they do see color and you do see color and they think that is important, it is important to take seriously why they say that. Why it is that your ability to walk through the streets white and their ability to walk through the streets black and get all kinds of stares and looks and disrespect, why that matters to them. Mm-hmm. Because when you say you don't see color, it means that you are denying many things that bad things that happen to black people on the basis of their color, because other people see their color just as they see the white color. So I think it's really important for people of goodwill, white people of goodwill, to understand that they carry with them privilege and that they have to be able to listen and understand why people want color to be acknowledged. That's really important.
We only have 4 minutes left. South Africans are often anxious about the solution space. I never am, because for as long as we don't share massive overlapping agreement about the nature, existence, and size of our challenges, rushing to talk about solutions is often just an attempt to not come to grips with reality. And we don't have shared realities, be that as it may. If somebody is listening to this conversation and they appreciate your problematizing of diversity, but the fact that you still have a solidarity politics at the heart of your work, and they're asking that anxious South African question, what must I do? How do you begin to address that?
I think there have been some very interesting moments in the student movement that has been budding in South Africa. With all its challenges, I think it has offered some profound moments. I think the moment when white kids stood up and put their bodies in between the police, recognizing that their white skin is a shield, was a very powerful symbolic one. So not to, you know, make them the heroes, so I don't think they were any braver than anybody else, but what they did was recognize that white skin matters. So when Claudia says, I wish people couldn't see my skin, what those white kids said is, people can see our skin, and we know that carries a power and a privilege. So this is how we will use it.
Mm.
We will use it in this particular moment to defend. And when someone else, when a black person says, I don't want you in between me and that police officer, or I don't want you in this other space, to be able to also respect and recognize that, because you have a power that other people do not have. Doesn't mean other people don't have other kinds of power. So I also don't want to make it act like white people are all things at all times and omnipotent. But I think that's a prime example. That's what people can do. Think about how privilege and power is used in you in a lived way, in a real way, not this theoretical stuff.
If you are a member of groups that have been oppressed in this geography that is South Africa, do you have burdens, or is it the beneficiaries of oppression who need to be most urgently asking themselves, what can I do, and can I begin to do the kind of thing that Sisonke is hinting at?
All of us. I mean, I am middle class through and through. I have had the most excellent educations. I have lived around the world, so I may have started from a place of absolute vulnerability and insecurity, but certainly I am someone with a lot of privilege and power. And so to not be honest about that, and to not take that seriously, and to not be burdened by that, my ability to enjoy the fruits of freedom in this country, mm-hmm. I think would be disingenuous and hypocritical. It's important for me to take it seriously, particularly if I'm demanding it of others.
Sisonke, the hour has flown by. Can't wait to have you back on the show. We're going to talk friendship. We're going to talk allies in two future installments. Sisonke has a book coming out this year. Congratulations.
Thank
it's
you.
Just about done. Can we pre-order it yet?
No, not yet. Not yet. Let me finish the final edits and get the galleys ready, and then we can talk about pre-ordering.
Is there a title?
It's called Always Another Country.
Always Another Country.
A memoir of exile.
Oh, lovely. Can't wait for it. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
The manuscript is done and dusted.
Yes.
Now, just for the final bits. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.